This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Use the Hijab 10 discount code for 10% discount on a wide range of products, including premium Ethiopian black seed products.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I am going to respond to a video that has gone semi-viral. You could actually say it's gone viral, depending on your definition, of course. A woman, a broadcaster from India, who has perpetuated falsehoods, really. Monstrous falsehoods, one after the other. Blunders, she's made blunders, mistakes, speaking with authority where she shouldn't have done so. And I'm going to be reacting to this video of this woman speaking about the Afghanistan situation, about the Taliban, about the Sharia law. In fact, the video is entitled, "What is the Sharia law?" So let's assess, in watching this video, whether this woman understands that which she's talking about.
There was a time when Afghanistan was a modern state. Faith was a private matter.
So already we're talking about modernity, right? So there's an assumption from the very outset that Western modernity, progressivism in that sense, is potentially the barometer or the standard that we should meet. Well, these assertions or these assumptions have to be evidenced in and of themselves. We don't need to go towards modernity or progressivism or Western culture. And if you do want to put us in that kind of category of going towards this and you think that's the right thing to do, then you have to argue for that from first principles. It's not good enough to just say, well, it's modernity and assume it. You have to argue it from the beginning.
And I come to you with arguably the most controversial concept in the world.
It's arguably the most controversial concept in the world. Of course, it's not maybe befitting for me to outline the fact that controversiality does not equate to falsity. And I'm not saying that she's saying that, but just to make sure that our audience or the end user here is fully familiar with this point. But is it the most controversial thing in the world? I mean, there are lots of things historically and contemporaneously that have been more controversial. The shape of the earth has been extremely controversial on the history of cosmology in the last 1,000 years. Even more controversial, you could argue, is sati, a practice called sati that was done by Hindu women historically and even up until the modern age, actually. And this practice involved a woman burning herself in mourning for her husband's death. Talk about women's rights, talk about all those things. It took the colonial powers, the British powers, to come and outlaw this thing. The white man to come and tell you what was right and wrong. Yes, no wonder why you're so obsessed with the white man, because he stopped you from burning yourselves. I mean, I understand the inferiority complex here. But let's not try and think now that this is the, once again, the barometer that we must all fulfill, or the standard that we must all meet, the white man standard.
Why is it so controversial? Why does the world fear it will take Afghanistan further back in time?
What do you mean by the world? Do you mean the white man? Is that what you mean? Or the Western powers, or colonial powers, or ex-colonial powers, or the superpowers? Who do you mean by the world? Okay, let's keep listening.
We've spoken to a lot of scholars and experts to put this report together.
You've spoken to a lot of scholars and experts, so I'm expecting what you say about Sharia law is going to be something which is academically robust. And if not, then you will be, obviously, to blame.
Thanks to the misrepresentation, manipulation and misuse of the Sharia. By whom? Islamic regimes, politicians, clerics, radicals, terrorists, they've all used the Sharia to rule in the name of God. So coming back to the question, what is the Sharia? Well, there is no...
That's not the exclusive property of religious discourse. Many radicals and terrorists have used secular ideology to do the same thing. So this is not an exclusivist discourse here. I mean, we can point to Stalin, we can point to even Lenin, we can point to Mao, we can point to many different people who had materialist ideologies and who did the same thing. So this is not an exclusivist discourse, and you shouldn't make it seem as if it is.
Where do the rules come from? Three sources: the Quran, which is Islam's holy book, the Sunnah, which is basically the deeds of Prophet Muhammad, and the Hadith, the sayings of the Prophet.
This is the first major blunder. It's actually a huge blunder. It's the Quran, the Hadith, which is the Sunnah. I don't know why you've separated the two things. And then the third thing is Ijma', which is consensus. And the fourth thing is Qiyas. And actually, Najmuddin al-Tufi, who is one of the specialists of the principles of jurisprudence, or Usul al-Fiqh, He mentions 11 sources altogether, including الاستحسان, الاستصحاب, شرع من قبلنا, قول الصحابي, the saying of the Sahabi, or the rulings of those who came before us in terms of the other legal systems of Moses and, for example, Abraham and so on. Maslaha, which is the idea of the common interest. All of these things are also sources of Sharia. And this is the reductionist understanding that has left a lot of people like yourself reducing the Sharia to just one or two sources. This is not the case. And in fact, you haven't even represented it correctly according to any school of thought, Shia or Sunnah. This is completely false. What you've said there is wrong. Listen to me carefully. What you said there is wrong. Because, once again, to reiterate, the four major masadir Sharia, if you like, or the four major sources of Sharia are the Quran, as you've mentioned, the Sunnah, which is the Hadith, which itself is subdivided into different types. Authentic, Sahih, yeah, Mutawatir, Sahih, Hasan, Hasan li ghayrihi, Daif, Mawdu', Matruk, so on. And these categorizations are known by the people of Hadith. And then you have Ijma', which is the legal consensus, which is defined by or as the consensus of the jurists in one specific time, in one specific issue, in one of the issues of the Islamic law. This is Ijma'. And then you have Qiyas, which is legal analogy. For example, if something is haram in the Quran, but then there's something which also has the same causative reasoning, they analogize onto it. For example, alcohol is haram. Also, wine is haram, let's say. They analogize onto that smoking weed is haram. Anything that intoxicates, hallucinogens are haram. Because it's maqis alay, it's analogized onto. And this is one of the masadir, if you like, one of the sources of Sharia. But these are the four main ones. There are other ones, like maslaha and mafsada. This is actually a source of Sharia. Maslaha is the common interest. A lot of people are asking, why is it that the Taliban are acting in a more pragmatic manner now? It's because of this source. See, if you knew these things, then you'd know how to operate and how to interact with those who you disagree with. You don't even know what the source of Sharia are. Therefore, your analysis is going to be reductionist, it's going to be false, and it's going to be lacking. Where are the scholars now that you said they don't even know what the basis of Sharia are in Islam?
There's a range of other sources to work out how God wants Muslims to live. But there is no single law book, no definite statute, no set judicial precedent.
That's false. There is a set judicial precedent. It's not precedent, it's precedent. And there is a set precedent from the Ijma'at. So when scholars make a decision on whatever issue is, they look at the ijma'at. If there's an ijma' or a consensus of a past, that acts effectively like a judicial precedent.
It's basically a vast collection of different, often conflicting interpretations.
That's not Sharia, that's fiqh. See, you're confusing it yourself. You said Sharia is different to fiqh because fiqh is the interpretations and Sharia is God's will. Now you're saying that Sharia has got different interpretations, which is false. You can't even keep up with your own script that you're reading in front of your face. This is ignorance compounded.
Interpretations gave birth to five schools of thought, five legal schools of Sharia. And you must know this. There are different kinds of Sharia.
We must know this, Yani. You're going to teach us. You must know this. By the way, there are more than four, five, six, seven schools of thought. These are the ones which have survived. There are many schools of thought. At-Tabari had a school of thought. Al-Awza'i had a school of thought. These big names had a school of thought. They just haven't survived. So if you want to be meticulous and you want to be precise, then don't speak in the way that you've just spoken.
I would say Hanbali, Maliki, Shafi, Hanafi. These four belong to Sunni Islam. The fifth is a Shia version of
What about Ismaili Shiites? What about Zaydi Shiites? You've completely missed a big chunk. See, you're all over the place. Zaydi Shiites, they are the majority of the Yemeni population of Shiites. You've completely left them out in your analysis here. How comes?
Sharia, it's called Jafri. All five of them are named after theologists and jurists, the men who...
Theologians and jurists, yes.
...interpreted Islamic texts. Now look at this map. The Hanbali school is the smallest and strictest of them all. Its primary...
What do you define as strict? It seems to be a very subjective reading. What do you define as strict? There's many rulings in the Hanbali school of thought. I'm not just saying that because obviously I come from that school of thought, but there are many rulings which are by and large more facilitative for many different people. So this is a very odd kind of subjective value judgment coming from someone who has no knowledge of any of the schools of thought. And you probably wouldn't, if I were to ask you why is it the strictest, you probably wouldn't know how to answer that.
Source is the Quran. It is practiced in Saudi Arabia and Qatar. It also has significant followers in these countries.
I mean, Saudi Arabia, yes, they practice a lot of people, a lot of jurists, a lot of mashayikh are Hanbali there, but there are a lot of Salafists who are not non-madhhabi actually in Saudi Arabia. And so once again, the awam, the lay audience, the lay people, this is very important for even us to know as Muslims. There's a difference between what the elitists or the clerics or whatever it is, they practice, and what the lay audience really doesn't have a madhab. Al-ammi la madhhab lah. The Ami doesn't really know about the Hanbali school of thought. If you ask him what's the difference between Hanbali and Shafi'i and Hanafi, they won't know the difference. So this is only applicable really to the elitists. But you wouldn't know that.
The Shafi school of Sharia relies on consensus over understanding of the Quran.
I dare you to find me one book from Imam Shafi'i's Risala, the first book ever written on Usul, by the way, in Islamic history. He's the one which is Islamic jurisprudence. I dare you to find me one book of Shafi'i Usul, which says that consensus is preferred over the Quran. There's no such statement made by any scholar in Islamic history. You've just made a fool of yourself, not realizing it, speaking nonchalantly and casually. This is embarrassing. This is totally embarrassing. Why are you speaking about these matters? You clearly are uneducated. You think you're educated? You're uneducated. You're being educated right now. You've just made a huge blunder. You said the Shafi'i school of thought relies upon consensus over the understanding of the Quran. And there is not even one scholar in Islamic history from any school of thought who's ever said such a thing. You fool.
The Hanafi school, the earliest, the most flexible version of the Sharia, it relies both on consensus and independent reasoning. The Hanafi school has the largest number
of... All of the schools of thought have qiyas, except for the Zahiri school of thought. So you're making it as if this is a speciality of the Hanafi method. It's not. Independent reasoning is qiyas, which is analogizing, causative reasoning, and then analyzing backward format. This is not a speciality of the Hanafi madhab. All of the madhab, except for the Zahiri madhab, which he didn't mention, has that feature.
They live in Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh.
Yeah, Afghanistan. So you've called it the most flexible form of Sharia, but how do you square that with the fact that the Taliban are implementing it? You see, there's contradictory messaging here in your broadcast. You don't even seem to realize it. That's how embarrassing it is.
But the problem begins when religion is mixed with governance.
She says the problem begins when religion is mixed with governance. That is a supposition. You're making an assertion. You've gone from informative broadcast to persuasive broadcasting. So now you're inserting a secular ideal. My question is, the presumption of secularity, how can you assert that without giving any evidence? What are your demonstrative proofs that secularism is the neutral way or the best way to live? Do you have any evidence in support of secularism? How do you even define secularism? Because if secularism is a division between church and state or religion and secular governance, my question to you is, what constitutes as religion? If you look at the sociological literature, you'll find that there's broad definitions which include political ideologies. Things like feminism, things like liberalism, and things like, ironically enough, constitutionalism and republicanism. Nationalism as well. So if that is the case, then to what extent can a government like yours in India, a nationalist government, a secular government, one that maybe claims to be liberal and democratic at the same time, all those things, could that be classified as a religious type of reasoning? Or a religious kind of thing in the first place? And if it is religious then it wouldn't be secular, and so once again your ideal would be dismissed. Why should we prioritize, even if barring or bearing into consideration secularism, why should we privilege political ideology over and above theological systems? Is there any argument that you have from first principles that lead us to that? So you see, the problem is you've inserted your opinion, my dear. And unfortunately, what you haven't done is provide any evidence. And the Quran states, قُلْ هَاتُوا بُرْهَانَكُمْ إِن كُنْتُمْ صَادِقِينَ. Bring your evidence if you're truthful.
many Muslims who embraced the Sharia thought of it as a substitute for the law of the land. And that's where the problem lies. The Sharia was just supposed to be a way of living.
So now you're making a theological claim. You're saying it's meant to be a way of living. It's not meant to be for governance. So, but how would you make sense of all the Quranic verses and the hadith, which clearly indicate that, which are addressing in the first place, politicians, generals and armies, and so on?
And while European nations later separated the church from the state, many Islamic countries did not. France, Britain and other European powers had colonized much of West Asia, Africa and Asia. When they left, leaders of the newly formed Muslim majority countries faced a dilemma. Should they govern based on previous Islamic values, or should they embrace laws inherited?
Leaders of those nations that you're talking about were usually puppet leaders installed by the colonial overlords that just left.
Well, they chose the Sharia as the basis of their legal justice system.
Well, you said it yourself, they chose. If that is what you believe, that they chose, and the people of the country chose that, and we say 96%, according to Pew, of Afghani people want the Sharia, isn't that a kind of democratic reasoning? And if it is a kind of democratic reasoning, on your worldview, shouldn't you be respectful of that and get out of their business? Why are you getting involved in other people's choices? You said they chose the Sharia. So what? Why is it, what's got to do with you as an Indian? What happens in Afghanistan or Iran or anywhere else? It's none of your business, with all due respect. You should focus on the minorities in India that are being killed and lynched, if you want to talk about rights, human rights.
What makes this law acceptable in some countries and horrific in others? Its understanding and implementation. Some countries enforce the most discriminatory and patriarchal...
Right, so what does... So if that's true, what would make it different from any other system? And now you've mentioned a key term, patriarchal. What if I reject the term altogether as a social construct? Because actually, if we say, for example, that patriarchy talks about oppression of men to women, then there's a whole range of backlash literature now, in the West even, that actually calls into question that very notion. Warren Farron himself talks in The Myth of Male Power about the fact that if you define power as somebody's ability to have control of their own life, then you can't say that men being forced to go to war and go into dangerous jobs and so on and so forth, that counts as power. And so your idea of patriarchy, therefore, will completely change. Forget about, okay, backlash literature. Even third wave feminists, people like Judith Butler, in her book Gender Troubles, she puts into the question this notion of patriarchy. So why should we assume patriarchy? Once again, you're assuming all these labels, patriarchy, modernity, progressivism, without arguing them for them first on first principles. Why should we be colonized mentally and ideologically as you and I in our respective nations were colonized physically by the British troops? Why are you submitting in this manner? Why? Is there some kind of inferiority complex perhaps that you have? Are you weakened by Western hegemony? Have you got nothing to offer? Or have you got nothing that you've extracted from your own culture that can compete with Western ideological hegemony? And is that the reason why you have such an inferiority complex? We don't feel the same way, unfortunately. And you know, the thing is, you and I both know the reason why you're speaking about Islam and they're all scared of it is because it's a sleeping giant that you don't want to wake up. Because it's the thing that for hundreds of years, civilizationally had brought all of these different nations together, multicultural, multiracial, and also multi-religious, under one banner. And it's the thing you're scared of, which is why in your country, your political leadership is doing what it's doing to the minorities there. Don't pretend. We know why you keep mentioning Muslims in your streams and Islam, because you're scared of it. You're a coward.
They selectively picked certain verses from the Quran and legalized draconian practices. Like polygamy, triple talaq.
How is polygamy a draconian practice? You seem not to even understand the words that you're using. Polygamy, by the way, is something which is sanctionable by liberalism. There's nothing wrong with polygamy on liberalism. Tell me one thing that liberalism opposes about polygamy. And by the way, Hinduism, which is probably the religion of your forefathers and predecessors, I don't know if it's your religion as well, but certainly it's the majority religion in India, allows polygamy. Let's take a look at what Zakir Naik, the guy, by the way, you tried to kick out of your country because he was converting the people to Islam. Yes, because of free speech. Let's see what he has to say about this matter.
If you read Ramayana, the father of Ram, King Dashrath, he had three wives. If you read the Vishnu Sutra, chapter number 24, verse number 1, it says a Brahmin can have four wives. If you read Mahabharata, Krishna had how many wives? Four? Ten? Thousand? 10,000? Krishna had 16,108 wives.
You didn't like hearing his voice, did you? It made you angry, didn't it? Like many of the Hindu nationalists, racists. I know how you feel about that man. But you can die in your rage, with all due respect. You can die in your rage. Because he still has changed the demographic of your country.
Genital mutation.
Genital mutation? You can't even say the word, dear. You can't even say the word. It's mutilation. Mutation, what is this? What is this? Transformers? What is this, a cancer? You can't even speak English properly, can you? It's mutilation. And you're saying this is meant in the Quran? And then underneath is not mentioned the Quran in any Quranic verse. So why mention it in the list with polygyny? It should be polygyny. Why polygyny and mutilation? Why are you putting them together? And by the way, triple talaq is haram. I mean, doing three talaq in one majlis is haram. Something that Islam doesn't allow, according to all schools of thought.
Does God judge differently based on gender?
No, the Quran actually answers that directly itself. إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يُضِيعُ عَمَلَ عَامَلٍ مِّنْكُم مِّنْ ذَكَرٍ أَوْ أُنْثَى بَعْضُكُم مِّنْ بَعْضٍ. That God does not let to waste any deed of those who do deeds from men and women, and both of them are from one another. Why are you mentioning this as if it's something that we believe in? Who are you even putting this to? You know the answer. If you're asking a theological question, the Quran says no.
For many clerics, it does.
It shouldn't do, because the Quran, I don't know of any cleric, scholar, alim who believes that. Give me one name of a scholar who believes that there is not such a thing as spiritual equality in Islam. We do not believe that equality in value means identicality in roles. So where there is physiological or psychological, whatever it may be, differences between men and women, there may be some facilitation for either man and or woman in the Quran or Sunnah. But we would say that is fully justified. Why should man and woman dress differently? In fact, you're talking about dress code. If I were to take my shirt off and a woman were to take her shirt off in this very country that I live in, the UK, yeah, do you think we'll be judged the same, even by the law in this land? No, the answer is not.
Despite the fact that women worked and fought alongside the Prophet, they won't tell you this. In some countries...
Who won't tell you this?
Women cannot step out without an abaya or a veil, but men can dress the way they want.
Really, can men dress the way they want, or is there not a restriction for them from the navel to the knee as well? Once again, you don't know Sharia and you don't know fiqh, so you're making blunders.
Women cannot stand for president, but men can govern for a lifetime.
Who said women cannot stand for president in Islam? Who said this? This is a matter of opinion, a fiqhi opinion. You mentioned this already. There's a difference between khilafa, okay, and wizara. And it's no consensus in Islam that a woman cannot stand for a president or if a leader of a country. There's no consensus to that effect.
Women cannot choose to have an abortion.
Women can choose to have an abortion before 40 days, according to the Hanbali madhab, if there is a reason for it. But abortion is not a Muslim-specific issue. I don't know why you're mentioning it. In fact, Islam has a more lenient view on abortion than Catholicism. Why are you mentioning abortion anyway? After a certain time period, many people would say, when the baby becomes viable or insolvent happens, then no, we shouldn't cause an abortion, because we are not going to prefer so-called women's rights on children's rights. So what are you talking about? Why are you now inserting abortion into this discussion? You seem to be secularizing the discourse even to the detriment of the American discussion on abortion. This is a discussion that's happening in America, whether abortion is okay or not.
But men are allowed to have four wives.
So what if men are allowed to have four wives? What's wrong with that? Why shouldn't men have four wives? In this country, in the UK, I can have 1,000 women sexual partners. 1,000, just like...
Krishna had 16,108 wives. So when Krishna can have 16,108 wives, so why can't we Muslims have at least four?
Women cannot travel without a male guardian.
Why would they want to travel in a country like India without a male guardian? The male guardians are being lynched themselves. Why would a woman want to risk it and get raped?
Drive. Women cannot retain custody.
Where does it say women cannot drive in the Islam? And in fact, I don't think any country now, the last one was Saudi Arabia, that's implementing that. They've stopped implementing that. And even their foreign minister, by the way, has said that this is a cultural practice of ours, has got nothing to do with Islam. So why are you mentioning that as if it's got something to do? Is this something that was even practiced in Afghanistan, that women can't drive? Is this something that was practiced in India or Pakistan or Egypt or Indonesia? So what's the proportion? My question is, now you're talking about demography. Saudi Arabia was the only country which banned women. 30 million people is 1.8 billion. So why are you generalizing such a small country in terms of population to the entire Muslim community in the world, 1.8 billion people? It seems to me like you're really clutching at straws here. And it seems to me like you're embarrassing yourself by using all these kind of orientalist tropes and kind of generalizing the discourse with it. How embarrassing.
Custody of their children after divorce.
And that's actually false. You said that women don't have custody of the children of I don't know who you got that from. In fact, women do have custody over their children over divorce. In fact, to the detriment of the man in most cases, unless she gets divorced and so on. Remarried again, and there's discussions about how that takes place. But what you're saying is false. Women do get custody of their children after divorce. And there's a hadith in Tirmidhi to that effect, where a woman came to the Prophet and said, I have raised the child and I've raised the thing. Put it on my lap and given it my milk and so on. And the Prophet said that you would be given custody of it, but if you get married, that the custody would be given to the man. And so the jurists differ as to how this would take place, but what you're saying is false. In fact, custody laws are bolstered for women in Islam. And in fact, there's so many things that I could even speak about in regards to breastfeeding and how breastfeeding can, some schools of thought say the man has to pay for it. The Hanbali school of thought, which you said was most strict, says you have to pay for the breast milk and so on. So you seem to me, as an ignorant person who doesn't know about Sharia and is conflating between cultural practices and the Sharia,
receive half of what is awarded to their brothers in inheritance.
Yes, but they also receive the same if they're a man, the same if they're a parent, and they receive the lion's share if there's two sisters. وَإِن كُنَّ نِسَاءً فَوْقَ اثْنَتَيْنِ فَلَهُنَّ ثُلُوثَ مَا تَرَكَ. The Quran states that if there's more than two women, they get 2/3 of what's left behind. It's a misconception to assume, therefore, that women inheritance get less than men in Islam.
All things, including religion, must evolve with time.
Okay, that's an assertion. If that's what you think, everything, including religion, must evolve with time. What is your evidence for that? And what is it evolving towards? Is it evolving towards Western Enlightenment value? And what makes Western Enlightenment value true? You have to be able to argue from first principles that liberalism is true, that secularism is true, that any ism that you decide to pluck out from the post-Enlightenment or Enlightenment discourse is true in the first place before you say evolution, because this implies progression.
If some practices are outdated, they must end.
Well, what about democracy? It's the most outdated practice known to Western ideology. It's a 3,000-year-old, it's a 2,000-year-old practice, 2,500-year-old practice. Yet we still practice it in one form or another. So this is the genetic fallacy. You're saying because of when something existed, it must end. What if something is true? What if it happened 1,000 years ago, but it's true?
Sharia's interpretation and practice clashes with today's way of life.
What's today's way of life? What the white man said? Is that what you mean by it? What the white man said? What the privileged white, colonial white man said?
Social structures, then perhaps it's time for revision and reflection.
And perhaps not.
Rather than resentment.
So as we've seen here, this is misinformation, lack of proper argumentation. If her argument was a building, okay, the foundations would be crumbled at the edifice. The building would be blown to bits and would be a pile or a heap of rubble. Next time when you try and speak about Islam, get your facts right or get ready to be embarrassed as you have been in this session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.